colorblind society. So why don't you join me each week as I try to satisfy my own curiosity and hopefully yours on these and other topics of conversation with politicians, pundits, personalities, and just everyday people on the Tavis Smiley Show.
Sunday afternoon at 2.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, cloudy today with a high of 40 degrees. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low of 33. Monday, mostly cloudy with patchy drizzle, a high of 47. Monday night, mostly cloudy with a low of 25. And Tuesday, colder, mostly sunny with a high around 30. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
As the new year approaches, we hope you'll consider WILL when making your year-end contributions. Listener support is the heart and soul of this radio station. Make your tax-deductible gift online at willpledge.org or by calling 217-244-9455. Thanks.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, December 13, 2009, here in Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Probably one of the most important issues in communication and media, one of the most important media matters today, concerns commercialization and new technologies and the effect upon all of us, in particular children. What are we doing to children? What's happening to children today as they're marinated in commercialism and advertising at every turn? Our guest today is going to be one of the great experts on the subject, a child psychologist who knows the material, studies it closely, and has a lot to say. Our guest will be Alan Kanner. He'll be joining us for the full hour here on Media Matters today. But first, before we go to him, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. Call them bloggers, citizen journalists, or just everyday people reporting the news, but online publishing has skyrocketed. The Berkman Center's Citizen Media Law Project was created to provide legal resources for individuals and organizations publishing online about a wide range of issues from free speech to news gathering to intellectual property. David Ardia is the director of the project. He explains that there are a wide variety of legal issues to consider in online publishing, which the project works to demystify.
Someone who wants to take on online publishing activities as more than just simply a hobby, something that they may do occasionally on a blog, they want to do it a little more seriously. They want to publish regularly. Let's say they want to do some original reporting. They actually do want to serve some sort of a news function for their friends or for their community. That as they start to get more serious about doing it, it makes a lot of sense to be thinking about it from the standpoint of, if I were starting a new business, what are the things I need to be concerned about? One of the big parts of that is a sort of legal part.
The Citizen Media Law Project has already produced a 900-page legal guide written for non-lawyers that addresses some of these important questions and hosts an online database documenting more than 800 threats directed at online speech. Its most recent initiative is the Online Media Legal Network, which provides individuals and organizations access to a network of lawyers who will provide pro bono legal assistance on a range of issues related to online publishing. The project fills a vital role in a media environment that is changing so rapidly.
What we're seeing is a set of laws and regulations that were developed in a very different environment, a body of law that sort of is being stretched and manipulated to fit in to the sets of facts that we're facing online. It isn't well suited to doing that. And so one of the things we're learning through all of this is that there needs to be a greater understanding among judges about new technology. There needs to be a greater understanding about lawyers about how technology is impacting the law. And very likely there needs to be some new laws that get made or some laws that are adjusted to deal with the challenges that we're facing with new media. But we're very much in the early part of that transition.
To find out more about the Citizen Media Law Project, go to citmedialaw.org.
In 2005, Jane Fonda, Robin Morgan, and Gloria Steinem founded the Women's Media Center to ensure that women's voices are prominent in the media. The group creates media content and engages in media advocacy campaigns. One of the center's most popular initiatives is the Progressive Women's Voices program, which trains women in broadcast, print, radio, blogging, and other techniques. Jamu Green is the new president of the Women's Media Center.
We get about 15 applications for every space that we have available. And these are amazing women who are leaders and organizers, and it's really paid off as they're making an impact in media at the highest levels.
Graduates of the program have appeared in the New York Times and Forbes magazine, and on the air at CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News, to name a few. They also maintain a database, shesource.org, for journalists, producers, and bookers to connect with women experts on a wide range of issues.
When we get the response from bookers or producers that the reason there are three white guys on talking about reproductive health is because they didn't have anyone they could go to, that we know that's absolutely not the case.
Coming from a background of political work and grassroots organizing, Green brings a unique perspective to her new job.
I'll be the first to admit that I am not a media expert. I have been and will always be, first and foremost, a grassroots organizer, and I am excited to bring my organizing skills to the Women's Media Center to make sure that we are capturing and providing opportunities for hundreds of thousands of women who watch and sit back and are affected by the fact that we are not included in equal representation in the media.
For Green, media and politics are one and the same.
The stories that the media tells, both about our biggest problems and who should solve them, often determine political reality. So as a political animal, I've been dealing with the realities of media my entire career. The power of the media and the importance of highlighting, amplifying voices that are not included in the process that has been a part of my political and organizing background.
For more information, go to womensmediacenter.com. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here at WILL AM 580. And 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana, online at WILL.illinois.edu. Here at Campbell Hall today, live December 13th. We've got a great show for you today. We're going to be talking about commercialism, technology, childhood, and capitalism and human happiness. As our guest today, we're glad to welcome a child psychologist and a writer from California joining us over the phone lines, Alan Kanner. Alan, welcome to Media Matters.
It's great to be here.
And for some of our listeners who might not be familiar, you are a writer who writes, a scholar, obviously, does academic papers, but also you write for Tycoon magazine on the subjects of commercialism and childhood and commercialism in general. And you also are connected to the Center for Commercial-Free Childhood. Talk a little bit, if you would, Alan, about first Tycoon magazine and secondly the Center for Commercial-Free Childhood.
Well, I am writing a column for Tycoon magazine, which is a progressive magazine that has a wide range of topics from politics to spirituality to culture, and among other things, although it's not something that I focus on, it's very interested in what's happening in the Middle East with Israel and Palestine. But within that framework, the readers of Tycoon are also critical, or at least willing to take a critical look at capitalism and some of the values that underlie it, and how that might be responsible for many of the problems that we're grappling with globally these days. The campaign for a commercial-free childhood is a relatively small group located in Boston. Our headquarters are in Boston, and our concern is all the harm that is occurring as a result of marketing to children, which has been getting heavier and heavier and more and more sophisticated since the late 80s in particular. And our goal is to eliminate marketing to children, which we do not see as either useful or necessary. If marketers really need to sell their wares, they can do so to parents, and the parents can decide which products are worthwhile for their children.
Alan Kanner, one of the big victories for the campaign for child-free or commercial-free, sorry,
yeah.
I've got the initials here, so I always gumped them up, CCFC, a campaign for commercial-free childhood. One of the great victories in the last few months has been surrounding Baby Einstein. It's an extraordinary story.
Yeah.
Explain what happened.
Well, in the history of recent marketing to children, the marketers first discovered that teenagers have much more money than anyone ever expected and knew about and were a great new target. And as teenagers were successfully marketed to, the trend got younger and younger, and then it went to tweens, which is roughly between 6 and 14, and then it went all the way down to, I think now it's about down to 4 months old, with products that were considered or at least marketed as being educational. That was the great hook to get parents of very young children to buy their products. And CCFC, my group, we were witnesses to these developments and were pretty appalled when the videos and all the quote educational material started to come out for children. And so we went to the research, and we found out that, in fact, there was no research supporting these claims. They were just fabricated, made up. And, in fact, the relatively small amount of research that existed indicated that there was some cognitive impairment involved later on in life for children who were exposed at very young ages, say under two, to media, so that the more hours they watched the media, the worse their cognitive functioning would be in terms of vocabulary and other kinds of measures later on, like at 7, 8, 9, 10. So there was this fraud essentially occurring in terms of marketing the educational materials to, or the materials as educational to parents. So initially, we filed a complaint with the Federal Trade Commission.
Let me interrupt you for one second, Alan.
Okay,
just
sure.
So people listening might not be familiar with this, because I had friends of mine who had an infant a few years ago, and I think they had Baby Einstein or Baby Mozart or Baby Tchaikovsky. I don't know what it was, but it was one of these things that's supposed to improve your kid's chances of getting into Harvard.
Right.
And they were obsessed with it. And so you take a very small kid and you sort of plank them in front of a screen, right?
Right. And so what you're doing, you're distracting the child and in a sense, mesmerizing them, but you're not educating them. They're not actually learning more about music or whatever it is that it's on the screen. And what you are teaching them is to be hooked on the screen, to become very needy of that kind of stimulation when there are no parents around. So the children are not learning to self-stimulate. They're not learning to play. They're not learning to interact with the rest of their environment. But instead, they're learning to passively view a screen. So the two problems, two major problems, are one that they're being taught to dependent on screens to stimulate themselves at a very, very young age, and then they're being taken away from other activities that in fact are far more stimulating and in fact will contribute to their cognitive, social, and emotional development. So it's a big problem to get these, you know, to put these children for hours in front of screens, and then the marketers who were afraid parents might be concerned about this came up with a very clever idea of saying, oh, no, you're actually doing your children a favor by doing this. You're going to help them achieve in later life. And since that was false advertising, we thought, you know, we would try to do something about it. And that's when we filed a complaint with the Federal Trade Commission accusing Baby Einstein and some other companies of false advertising. The FTC, which was under Bush at that time, basically agreed with us but did nothing. And they wrote back to us and said, well, because of your complaint, we talked to Disney, and Disney has now taken some of their claims off of their website and off of their packaging. So everything, you know, everything is good now, and we expect, since it's Disney, that the other companies will follow suit. And we said to the FTC, but they broke the law. You know, false advertising is against the law. And the FTC just didn't answer us.
Mm-hmm.
So we were still upset about this. And the next thing that we did was to contact some public health lawyers and provide them with some upset parents about Baby Einstein, parents who had used Baby Einstein and their kids hadn't gotten smarter. And these lawyers sent a letter to Disney saying, in essence, that they were going to sue them for false advertising if they continued to market Baby Einstein as educational. We were not part of the suit, and we just kind of set it up. And then what happened was interesting in a number of ways. One was that we lost touch somewhat with what was going on between the lawyers and Coca-Cola. And initially the lawyers had talked to us about Coca-Cola wanting us not to talk about this if there's any kind of deal, and we didn't agree to that. And that's when, as I said, we started to lose touch with what was going on. But we discovered that, in fact, on the same date that the demand letter went out for the lawyers, that Coca-Cola had put on their website that they were going to give a refund to anyone who, any parents who had bought the Baby Einstein products in the last 5 years, up to 4 products, a full refund. Disney had not publicized, as far as we could tell, this refund anywhere. We searched all over the internet, and we could find no mention of it. Now, Bob, as you know, Disney has some talent at marketing. I mean, they know how to get the word out if they want to. So what we finally did is we contacted some newspapers and said that there was this refund, and yet no one knew about it. And so then it reached the front page of the New York Times, I think, in October, and you know, caused quite a splash, because most people, I think, do believe that that Baby Einstein is educational and are unaware of the fact that the American Association of Pediatricians has been recommending for a number of years that children under 2, which is the target audience for Baby Einstein, have no screen time whatsoever, and they're concerned about future cognitive development, and that's why they've made this recommendation.
Our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to, Alan Kanner, child psychologist, involved with the campaign for commercial-free childhood. It was written widely on the subjects we're talking about in today's program. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. Our phone number here at WILL is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. The phone lines are open. And, Alan, I want to go into some more on children and marketing and advertising and some of the broader issues that you touch on in your writing. But first, for people who are unfamiliar with this issue and don't really know much about it, What exactly is bad about advertising commercialism towards children? What is the case against it? Why should we be that concerned? I mean, after all of us growing up were exposed to advertising, and we seem to survive.
There's a number of reasons for some reason that may not be real clear. Most of the advertising is for products that are bad for children. The vast amount of marketing is for junk food. That's the head of the list, for violent media, for sexual clothing and makeup and other kinds of materials for children or for girls, particularly who are preteens and younger, for violent media. As a child psychologist, I cannot recall the last time I have had a boy come into my practice who's six or older who was not involved in violent, with violent video games. And each of these, so drug and alcoholism, the addiction to alcohol or to tobacco needs to occur before 21, or those respective industries would go out of business. In other words, if people become addicted after 21 to either of those drugs, they're not likely either to stay addicted or there's not enough of them to keep the companies in business. So they absolutely depend on early addiction for their economic survival. So those array of products that I just mentioned are the ones that are most sold to children. That covers a huge percentage of what's being marketed.
Alan, what about the issue of what it does to actual kids' brains and development? Does advertising affect that at all?
Well, I would say that, I would say that it affects their values considerably. I don't think the advertising per se is doing anything more to their cognitive development than watching TV shows would be doing. It's the same kind of problem. It's pulling children away from activities that are far more beneficial to them. But the materialistic values that are the theme of advertising is a huge problem because it's the marketing is teaching children that in order to be happy, they need to have an ongoing accumulation of stuff, of more and more products, and without that, their life will be empty and meaningless. Beyond that, and this is something I do write a lot about, because we're living in the world of corporate capitalism, the corporations realized about 20 years ago or so that they didn't need to just sell their products, but they needed to sell themselves. They needed to brand children. And so they have started to sell what I call corporate materialism, and that means that children are coming to believe that it's not just running shoes that they need, but they need Nike. And to come to identify, to come to be branded with these corporations, and in so doing, the children are also coming to the belief that in order to be happy, they need to be part of this global corporate economy where corporations basically create a homogeneous culture based on their products that's worldwide, and that the children are buying into this vision of this glorious future where these very large corporations supply us with everything that we need, and that's the road to happiness. So it's a subtle way of training children to be members of the global economy.
Does that, in your view, produce happier people? I mean, as a psychologist who spends a lot of time on this, it's really sort of a bottom-line question. Does this deliver?
No. And there's a great deal of research here. I work with a colleague of mine named Tim Kasser, who's actually created materialism scales. And Tim and many of his colleagues for quite a few years now have been churning out one study after another based on populations all around the world. There's a lot of cross-cultural research that indicates that once your basic material needs are met for housing and clothing and food, the correlation between how happy or satisfied you are with your life and how much money you have or how wealthy you are is zero. So something else needs to kick in at that point once our basic material needs are met to make us happy. And it's probably no surprise that it has to do with the quality of your relationships, your family and your friends, the meaning, how meaningful your work is, these other non-materialistic aspects of our lives.
Our guest today, you just been listening to, Alan Kanner, child psychologist, expert on commercialism and children and child development and commercialism in general in our society. The phone number here at WILL AM 580 is 333-9455. If you'd like to join in, our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Let's go to our first caller right now. Line one, Champagne, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Alan Kanner.
Yeah, thank you. I have a 2-year-old granddaughter and a 7-year-old grandson in different families. Let me put these out here. What about Sesame Street and Barney? And then I wanted to ask my daughter-in-law is a teacher, and she teaches in a Hispanic neighborhood school in Chicago, and they live in a Hispanic neighborhood. So, and she's fluent in Spanish. And the 2-year-old seems to be understanding all the kids on the street. Doesn't really actively speak much Spanish. But when my daughter-in-law needs to prepare for school, which is high school, she'll split the screen on the computer, and she'll do her stuff on one half. She'll have her daughter on her lap, and she'll have basically video jukebox for babies. It's like little songs, often Spanish songs, Spanish language songs, and they have little cartoons that go with them, which the child really loves. So I was wondering what you thought about that kind. This child is now, she's like 28 months.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's been viewing screens for a long time.
Yeah.
And the 7-year-old, he's like totally addicted to his electronic games.
Right. Well, this is a story I hear a lot, or stories that I hear a lot, and it's understandable that the parents have been told that this is beneficial for their children, and why should they doubt that? Back to Sesame Street and Barney, what I suggest is that parents provide toys that are not branded, because any kind of toy like Barney is a kind of a lead into a whole world of products that are associated with Barney, in including movies and games, and it just goes on and on and on. So my suggestion is to find non-branded products for that reason. A second related reason is, say, if your child sees a Barney movie and then gets a Barney teddy bear or something like that, what the children do when they're characters in the media is that they repeat what they've seen on the TV or in movies or wherever, and they do not play creatively with the toys. They just mimic, and it's even difficult sometimes to get them to do anything else, even if you make a suggestion that that the teddy bear do something that's out of character, they won't go along with it. So it actually, this is an instance where it reduces their creativity.
Alan, let me ask you about the second part of her question about her 7-year-old.
Yeah.
There's a debate I know between researchers on whether there's a difference between passively watching a screen And then a kid who gets involved in video games or computer games is participating. Mm-hmm. And some people claim that that is a qualitatively different phenomenon, and that it, you know, kids are being proactive, aggressive, and it's much more valuable and constructive and not necessarily a negative experience. Mm-hmm. What's your position on that debate?
Yeah, well, first we need to talk about, I guess, violent and nonviolent, but certainly the gruesomeness of the violent media keeps rising, and so that it's common for an 8-year-old or 9-year-old to be playing a game in which the character murders a prostitute after having sex with her in order to get the money back.
So, whoa, I mean, wait, time out.
Time out?
Yeah, what is that? There's games for 8-year-olds like that?
Oh, yeah. Yes. I mean, you know, they're supposedly for older kids, but the 8-year-olds get them. Get their hands.
Older, like 10-year-olds?
Yeah.
Who's the target audience for a show about killing a prostitute?
In order to get the money back.
Yeah.
After having, yeah. So, I mean, it's people, if you haven't actually seen what's out there, you would be absolutely shocked. It's very gruesome. And the blood and the sadism and the you know amorality on and on like that. So I just would want to say, and I've had a lot of boys in my practice tell me that they're not using the violent video games because they've seen the really gruesome ones, and I ask them, what are you using? And then they describe a plot where it's just aliens murdering everyone on Earth, and you know it's nothing but war. And they say that's not violent. So and it isn't compared to the worst, you know, the most violent products out there. But it is, of course, violent. The other thing we need to be asking ourselves is, what are they learning? What skills are they developing? They're developing certain very narrow visual motor skills with the video games, and they get very, very good at those. But there's a whole range of other developmental skills, especially social ones, that they're not developing. You know, they need to be out there playing with their friends.
Do you think along those lines, too, that, you know, I've had a guest on this program in the past talk about these issues. Is there a correlation between increased use of sort of individualistic sort of electronic equipment and a decline in, say, conversational skills?
You know, I don't know if that research has been done.
Okay.
If so, there's not nearly enough of it out there.
Well, on that note, we do have a couple of callers who are waiting patiently. Our guest today, Alan Kanner, child psychologist, joining us from California, talking about commercialism and new technology in children and society at large, and broader questions of human happiness. What makes it, and how does it relate to commercialism and material wealth? Let's go to our phone lines again. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Alan Kanner.
Hi.
Hi.
Okay. I'm 7 years old. I have two questions.
Mm-hmm.
We do not have a TV. I listen to a lot of NPR.
Mm-hmm.
How does radio affect the brain development?
Well, first, thank you so much for calling. It's great to hear from you. Radio allows your imagination to work much more than television does, because television provides the pictures in your head, and so you don't have to make them up yourself. Whereas, right now, you need to make up a picture of me, and everyone else has to make up a picture of you in their heads as we have this conversation. So radio actually asks a lot more of us than television does. Do you have a second question?
Yes. My friends watch TV and play video games.
Mm-hmm.
Makes it harder to play with them because they want to do different things than I like to do.
Yeah. And this is a problem that almost all the parents I talk to who are trying to reduce the amount of media their children are exposed to are concerned about. So thanks again for bringing that up. There's a couple things that I would suggest. One is, if your parents know other parents who are doing the same kind of thing. It would be very useful for them to get in touch with those parents, because if you just had one or two friends, and maybe you do, who aren't that way, it would make a big difference in your life. So that's a lot of parents try to do this all by themselves, and they don't talk about what they're doing. And I don't know how much your parents, you know, talk to other parents about what they're doing, and then they don't find out that there's other parents with the same concerns and who are fighting all of this marketing, again, in an isolated way or all by themselves. The other thing, and it's part of growing up, and it's an unfortunate one, but sometimes we have to be different than other people in order to do what it is that we really believe is good for ourselves or the right thing to do. And it's just a lesson in life that we sometimes have to learn. And maybe in time your friends will start to get interested in some of the fun things that you're doing, so that when they come over to your house, if your parents could have a lot of fun things to do, some of the things that you do, I guess with perhaps arts and crafts, paper and pencil and drawing and this kind of thing, your friends could join you.
Caller, any more questions or comments?
Thanks.
Well, thank you very much for calling.
Yeah.
Before we go to our next phone line, our next caller, just real quickly, a little background. You were featured in the documentary Consuming Kids, which is an excellent introduction to the issues we're talking about. And in that documentary, they lay out something which a lot of Americans, especially younger Americans, aren't familiar with, which is that this hyper-commercialization of childhood is really a relatively recent phenomenon. It's not something that's like part of American history since 1776.
Right. Yes, in fact, as I was mentioning earlier, it wasn't until like around the mid-80s that economists, as it were, discovered all of this discretionary income that children had. And before that, there was just advertising on Saturday afternoons on the television, or Saturday mornings, for cereal and toys. And that was really it. And when this discovery got made, that's when they started marketing to the teenagers initially. And there was this huge explosion. And for many, many years, marketing to children was the fastest expanding market in the country. And then, of course, it's gone international since then. So now it's everywhere. So it is a very new thing. And as I had mentioned earlier, there's no reason to market to children. And it's unfair because the children don't have the cognitive capacity until they're about eight to even know what a persuasive argument is all about. And what that means in English is the children don't understand that the marketer doesn't have their best interests at heart. They just believe whatever's being
said. You know, on that note, Alan, to date myself, I remember almost the exact day when I was a boy, and I forget my age. I think I was a very naive boy. I think I might have been as old as nine.
Mm-hmm.
That I found out that commercials were like paid for, weren't part of the show. And it was a shock to me. I couldn't believe it. I was like, it was just beyond my comprehension. I thought that was such a natural part of the landscape.
Right.
That they were somehow someone had to pay to get those into the rest of the programming.
Yeah. Well, no, you're pretty normal. I mean, eight or nine is you know, right about when that awareness kicks in. But even 16-year-olds don't have the same cognitive sophistication that, say, a 21-year-old has. And so marketers just can run, you know, circles around them.
You know, before we go to our next caller who's waiting patiently, we've got a couple here. I promise I'm going to get to you in a second. I do want to ask, you know, when I do shows on this, and I try to do a program on commercialization in childhood or just commercialization in general at least once every two or three months because it's such an important issue, invariably the phone lines get crammed. Listeners are really interested. What everyone's political viewpoints are, this is an issue that really strikes a chord with everyone. And yet, there's almost not, it's completely, or not almost completely, but it seems to be largely uncovered in the media and the culture. I mean, it's like a non-spoken issue.
Yeah. Well, look who owns the media. It's the marketers, right? It's the same folks who, especially as the media gets, eaten up, as it were, by just a handful of huge media corporations. So they are certainly not going to be critical of themselves and their own source of funding. So it is very hard to get media attention on this. Adbusters, a number of years ago, had a public service announcement that was pretty funny, that was critical of materialism. And they tried all of the major networks and all the cable networks to get it put on. They were willing to pay the full fee. And the networks were quite honest, and they said, we don't want to antagonize our sponsors, so we won't accept it. We won't accept your money, and we won't broadcast your perspective. So there's a kind of censorship that goes on that way that's institutionalized.
Well, that censorship doesn't go on here, obviously. Yeah, no, the benefits of public radio. Our guest, Alan Kanner, child psychologist. You've been listening to. We're talking about commercialism, happiness, childhood, new technologies. Any questions or comments along those lines are welcome. We've got a full bank of callers. I'm going to get to all of you. Let's start right now. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Alan Kanner.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Comment, if you would, please, on how your work is, how you would compare your work to the phenomenon in our society, and it's probably in other Western societies as well, of I don't know how to describe it exactly, but give it the name, individual identity via purchase. As an example, the individuals that I know and one can see on the street all the time that are, they own a Harley-Davidson motorcycle. So they have Harley-Davidson pants, and they have a Harley-Davidson shirt, and they have Harley-Davidson boots, and they have Harley-Davidson cigarettes.
Right.
And so on and so forth. And one can see on campus, people wearing clothing that they pay a premium for that mm-hmm. has a corporate name on it.
Yeah.
Which is not the same as, to tell a little story, my father, when he was a wee lad in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, growing up in the 20s and 30s, there was a Coca-Cola bottling plant there.
Mm-hmm.
He put a sign on his bicycle that said, drink Coca-Cola. If he went by the bottling plant once a week, they gave him a free bottle of Coca-Cola as compensation for his advertising, which isn't the same as shucking out, something in three figures to wear to tell the world that, I love DuPont paint because Jeff Gordon has a car that says DuPont paint on it and stuff like that, which seems pretty silly to me. So, I mean, if the people at DuPont want to give me the jacket, I'll wear it, but I'm not going to pay a nickel for it. So comment on that, if you would, please, and how it seems, if it relates at all to this phenomena, which the way you describe it, it sounds like if what you're saying is going on, I have no doubt it is. It's just priming the pump for that,
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, caller.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.
This goes back to the branding that I mentioned earlier, where customers or consumers, as they like to call them or call us, is become loyal to a brand. They have a term they call brand loyalty, and so the brand has a certain shine to it, or a certain charm, a certain magnetism that allows them to add a few more bucks to the product just because it's made by Harley Davidson, for example, as opposed to any other motorcycle company. So when Harley Davidson then goes into pants, they carry all of their customers with them, and now the customers like the pants because it has the Harley Davidson logo on it, and on. And so this is what the marketers mean by branding consumers, is getting them hooked on the corporation, even beyond any particular product. So that allows the corporation to go in multiple directions in terms of its products, in directions that have nothing to do with the original product, and still have a loyal customer base.
Well, let's go to our next caller now. Line 1, Bloomington, you're on the air with Alan Kanner.
Hi, I'm really enjoying this. I'm struck by, there are just so many parallels to the work like that was coming out of the Frankfurt School in the first part of the last century and on consumerism. I'm really kind of one of those people that, if it seems to be doing nothing wrong, if it's just building a brand loyalty, perhaps for the rest of one's life, you know, that's a very, it seems to me, a very mild harm, as is, I suppose, you know, inculcating kids with advertising. However, I think I, like a lot of people, it's as though, even though this is a long and distinct and unquestionable process, you know, I need something like the violence to hit me with, you know, and say, okay, here's why it's bad. Here's when it turns bad, and here's when it has negative effects for society. So if you could please speak to that, I'd love to hear more about that. You know, I see what goes on in society, and, you know, I try to avoid brand specifics, but, you know, you also have kind of larger, at sort of a mega level, or a meta level, rather, companies like, you know, Walmart, who are, you know, who sell many branded products, but not that many of their own, but, you know, when it comes down to it, they do many good things for the community, and they try to build goodwill. And, you know, anyone who's ever been in corporate America knows why. It's because you want people to come back. Yeah. So please speak to that. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, Carla.
Yes, thank you. There's so many ways to go. I want to get to the very big picture that you mentioned. Let me quickly, you know, reiterate, for example, that the obesity crisis that we're having worldwide right now and with children is driven by the marketing of junk food. And the corporations have lobbied very successfully against any kind of regulation by claiming that they will self-regulate. Of course, they've been self-regulating while this has all happened. And,
yeah.
And the marketing hasn't gone down. And then they come up with all kinds of schemes that for labeling how healthy the foods are, and the public health advocates that I know are tearing their hair out around the schemes because the schemes are ridiculous. And so they're never going to self-regulate themselves if it's going to hurt their profits. And that's the problem.
You know, Alan, let me just ask you real quickly, because this is the question that always comes up. I mean, you say, if I'm not mistaken, at this point, just ban advertising and commercialism to children under 8 or 12?
I would go to 18.
18.
Myself.
Is that, first of all, is that enforceable if you wanted to do it the way advertising permeates textbooks and text messages and everything in our culture on one hand? And secondly, does it violate the First Amendment to restrict the speech of advertisers?
Okay. And I will answer that, but let me also mention that these corporations that are making all this money are now driving world politics with their huge profits. So it's not so harmless that they're just getting a few kids to buy their brands. It's that they are twisting international politics and national laws around the globe to make it easier for them to sell their products at the expense of everything else, including democracy. That's a whole other discussion, but it's not such an innocuous process that's going on. The free speech question is what my progressive colleagues always ask me about or criticize me for, even if I bring this up. And what's interesting for me around that is that when it comes to advertising is a special kind of speech that is pretty much unlike all other kinds of speech in that it requires money to engage in it. And the more money you have, the more you get to speak through the media. And so the rich corporations get to talk the most. This is decidedly undemocratic. This is a structural situation that needs to be rectified. And in any kind of democratic media that we're going to design, we need to address this core issue. What do we do about the fact that if it's commercialized, that means that the people with the most money are going to be able to have the greatest access and essentially to speak the most? And so when I talk about banning advertising in general or banning advertising to children, then we have to think about, well, we have banned speech or restricted speech in many, many instances in this country historically when we've thought that the speech would do too much harm. You can't lie in court. There's just many, many examples. You can't sexually harass someone, whether we agree with this or not. You can't protest at a mall because it's on private property, and so the mall has the right to limit speech in those instances. And what's happened with corporate advertising in particular is that not only does it dominate the airwaves, but it doesn't allow other perspectives in, like I was talking about earlier with Adbusters. And so it's evolved now into a kind of propaganda arm for materialistic values. It's beyond simple advertising of products, because there's so much of it. It's everywhere. It's so sophisticated, and it has this meta message of buying corporate products in order to make oneself happy, that it's like propaganda. And lastly, we have child labor laws because corporations will exploit children as workers. And we finally got to the point where we realized we had to stop the corporations by making laws. So when it comes to children, I don't even think we need to go to free speech to say we need to protect children, that they're a special population, they're especially vulnerable to the advertising. It's unfair to advertise to them. A two-year-old cannot evaluate their Oshkosh bib. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to have these very sophisticated, well-funded adults who are studying these little kids day in and day out and are unscrupulous about it, to allow them at them as much as they want. And as a society, I think we can step in and say, no, we're going to protect our kids. We're going to let them grow up in a commercial-free environment and go from there.
Alan, you've done a lot of talk in a lot of writing about spiritualism and commercialism and the conflict there. I was wondering in your career, in your work, if you've done outreach to conservative religious groups that tend politically to support sort of the free market cowboy capitalism on one hand, but are deeply concerned about the erosion of values that this sort of free market capitalism creates.
Yes, we've done some of that through CCFC. We've had some conservative religious groups that have joined us on some of our campaigns and actually made contributions to us and come to our conferences. And we kind of agree to disagree on the other topics. And it's sometimes a little bit of an uneasy coalition, but there are a lot of conservative parents who don't like the values that are being passed along by the commercial world. And in that sense, they're right on board with us.
Let's go back to the lines. We have two callers. I promise to get to both of you. Let's start now. Line 3, Champagne, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Alan Kanner.
Yeah, I called before, and you didn't answer my question about Sesame Street. And you didn't say anything about the program, Barney, rather than the products. Of course, Sesame Street doesn't have advertising.
No, Sesame Street doesn't have advertising, but they have millions of dollars make millions and millions of dollars a year on their products that are based on the show. And so they're exploiting, unfortunately, the show itself, which is wonderful, and kids really enjoy it. But they're taking these and they're making all these dolls and these other products based on the various characters and games and things like that. And it's a huge industry.
But does that affect the pedagogical value of the actual TV show kids are experiencing, that they go out and buy a Cookie Monster doll?
No, but the show then gets, well, I don't know if it does. I mean, I don't know how much they design the shows based on what products are selling well. I just can't speak to that. There's always that possibility. But what it does is it draws the children into this commercial world again, so that by watching the show, they're going to walk into a store and want to buy all this stuff. So it's taking the the value of the show and using it or manipulate, you know, using it as a manipulation to sell the products. And it's that's what we object to. We if they would discontinue all of these products that are so, because what do the products have to do with the?
Well, let me ask you this, Alan. The late, great Neil Postman wrote famously that Sesame Street, when it was receiving all this praise, didn't really teach kids to love learning. It just taught them to love television.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he was basically cynical, or skeptical is a better word, about using television or screens to really be a pedagogical tool effectively.
Yeah.
That it was largely just the technology was negative. What's your take on his position?
Okay, well, you know, I agree with Neil. I mean, I know I have a 5-year-old myself who's never seen a TV show in her life, and her imagination is just active all the time. I mean, it any moment she's ready to play, and if I give her, you know, she does the thing that a lot of kids do. You give her a present, and she's more involved with the wrapping than she is with the present. So she needs very little to go on, and she creates toys herself just out of anything all the time. And she has imaginary friends. She doesn't need Mickey Mouse, et cetera, et cetera. And so I don't think that it's very healthy for children to be spending very much time in front of a screen.
On that note, we only have a couple minutes left. I do want to get to our final callers and waiting patiently. Line 4, Charleston, you're on the air with Alan Kanner.
Yes, I've been, hello, I enjoy your show, by the way. I got a lot of things, a lot of notes that I've been writing down through the course of this conversation concerning, you know, commercialism and children as the end products, the end points of a lot of goods, you know, needful or otherwise. I have a very important question. I read a book by a Melody Peterson a couple summers ago about entitled Our Daily Meds, and it talked principally about adults and the pharmaceuticals capturing, you know, captive audience, certainly today in our culture of the sick, you know, where just about anything is potentially, you know, pathological behavior, that is. What can be said about the long-term cultural implications of advertising medicines, drugs to purportedly to adults, but ultimately getting into the hands of, you know, parents who, you know, are told that, you know, your child has a problem? What I mean, 1970, just to kind of end on this note, 1970, I believe the statistics on children on Ritalin was 200,000 thereabout.
Right.
And today we're looking at in the tens of millions of children being drugged, I hate to say into oblivion, but to me it seems that, and, you know, there comes a point where one asks oneself.
Caller, I hate to interrupt, but I'm afraid this is going to become a true-false question with the amount of time we have left.
We don't have pressure on this, but I'll
if I lost him.
I think so, too. Go ahead. Alan, any comments on a very important question? I'm sorry we couldn't give him more time.
Yeah. Well, your doctors are reporting tremendous amount of pressure from patients to use drugs, and you know that they've been advertised to, and people are coming to them all worried about a lot of different illnesses that they don't really have.
Well, you as a child psychologist of all people probably are familiar with this, and unfortunately, though, I don't think we have time to give that subject the attention it deserves. Before we do wrap up today, though, quickly, where should people go if they want to do follow-up on this issue, Alan Kanner, learn more or get involved?
Sure, www.commercialfreechildhood.org, commercialfreechildhood.org. There's a huge amount of information.
Well, thank you very much, Alan Kanner, for joining us today on Media Matters. It's been wonderful having you.
Yeah.
I want to thank Kyle Kroha for working the board, as always, my producer, Melissa Trentz, for her great work. 1 week from today, 167 hours, we'll have a show with the author of a new book, but the person playing the music in the background right now that you've been listening to for the last 7 years on this program, Biography of Thelonious Monk by Robin Kelly, 1 week from today. I'll see you then.
To Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather.